It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, roadside memorials have become a way to publicly document and create a space dedicated to a lost loved one. We hear from a Wisconsin artist who's been photographing these sites around the state. First, if your property was damaged by recent flooding or severe weather, would you know what to do and what not to do? Wisconsin insurance officials have some advice beyond just calling the insurance company. We'll talk with the state insurance commissioner right after we get a quick check on the weather. Hint, more rain on the way. Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. Chad, welcome back.
And Rob, how are you doing today?
Okay, well, bad news it sounds like. We've had so much rain and there's more coming, right?
Yeah, there certainly is, and this will be a more of a heavy rain producer for at least some parts of the state that weren't absolutely inundated with the rainfall, and that's mainly the southern third of Wisconsin last week. We have some satellite estimates that show just in the last 14 days, up to 15 to 20 inches of rain has fallen in and around that I-39, I-90-94 corridor in south-central Wisconsin. So the heavier rain threat that'll come up for tonight is going to be more so for about Eau Claire northeastward into parts of the Northwoods. So we'll be affecting an area of the state that hasn't been hit as hard. But as you mentioned, there's still so many different issues going on in southern Wisconsin. By the time this system rolls through, a good portion of that part of the state will still pick up another inch to 2 inches by the time this is done by Thursday.
I was looking at the weather situation report. It started by saying this is not a normal situation. Who is going to get that abnormally big rain this time around? What communities are going to be hit?
It looks like for the heavy rain threat where it's setting up right now, and it'll depend here in the next couple of hours where those showers and storms really get a better organized. You're probably looking more so of a line from about the Twin Cities, Rochester, Minnesota, through Eau Claire. Hayward would be included in that, up through Price County, Phillips included, Medford, and eventually up to Rhinelander and Eagle River. Those areas will be under the gun for the heaviest amount of rainfall. Some rainfall totals could be approaching 4 inches or so by the time we get some of this humidity out of the air by Wednesday afternoon. So a little bit different area of the state of Wisconsin, but we still have so many different water issues. And then, of course, when it goes into the northern part of the state, you start talking about the Wisconsin River that's the tributary that's going to bring it all southward anyway. So this will still bear some watching. There are flood watches out across a good portion of central Wisconsin at this time, and we'll have to wait and see if any more flood watches get extended farther southeastward as the showers and storms become more organized going into tonight.
And there's a chance of severe weather threats, wind, maybe tornadoes with this one. Do I have that right?
Yeah, correct. Right now, it looks like the strongest threat will be in those areas where the heavy rain is possible, west central Wisconsin, and that'll be for in southwestern into west central Wisconsin. That is mainly for a wind event. There's really not much of a chance for any kind of large hail because of how warm and humid the conditions are, but because of some upper level support coming in later on this afternoon into tonight, there is a small chance for some tornadoes, and that biggest threat would be from La Crosse northeast or right into about Marathon County, the Wausau area, and Marshall, Wisconsin Rapids could be included in that as well. So that would be the greatest threat as we head into the early evening hours and late evening hours for tonight.
Chad, I'm looking out the window and I see this strange thing. No visible water droplets. Something's shining, some kind of light in the sky. I don't know what that is. Is there any indication that, hey, we're going to have some sustained dry weather around the state anytime in the next couple weeks?
Yeah, you know, it's looking pretty good right now. So after this storm system gets done through the area, and it'll be done with all of Wisconsin, northwestern Wisconsin by tomorrow morning, southeastern Wisconsin by late tomorrow night. But by all intents and purposes, it looks like behind that Thursday, Friday, and a good portion of the weekend, that's when we'll start to see some drying conditions finally return to most of the Badger State. We'll be looking at lots of sunshine Thursday and Friday. And then we have to kind of focus a little bit on the far southern part of Wisconsin, northern Illinois area, because what will be the remnants of Hurricane Gordon, assuming that's where the strength gets to here in the next 12 hours, those remnants are going to try to get back up into the parts of the upper Midwest. The latest that we've looked at in the last 24 hours looks like it could get right up to knocking on the doorstep along the state line just south of Janesville. But otherwise, if we get through that with Gordon on Saturday, things are smooth sailing Sunday into early next week, looking pretty good as temperatures will rebound back to the 70s, and we get some dry weather, some good drying conditions coming up for the second half of the weekend into early next week.
We'll look forward to that. Chad, thanks for bringing us up to date.
No problem, Rob. Have a great one.
You too. That's Chad Franzen, meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. Now we shift our focus to what we should do if the weather damages our property. Lots of damages, $44 million in public infrastructure so far, according to the state. In Dane County area alone, $69 million of private property damage. Besides calling our insurance agent when bad things happen because of rain and flooding, what do? Ted Nickel is the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner. Commissioner Nickel, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, thanks so very much for having me.
Well, you put out some guidelines there at the Insurance Commission. What's our first move when we've got weather-related damage?
Your first move, and again, thank you for the opportunity, your first move is to identify areas of loss and begin the process of protecting your valuables and to protect any damaged items. What you don't want to do is just find out that something has been damaged and throw it away. So you want to take a good strong inventory of your personal belongings, take photos, take video of damaged property, and make sure you have that available for when you contact your agent or your company directly.
Right. I would think, oh, we've got the wet carpet, we've got the damaged wood, whatever. We want to just get rid of that, throw it out there. You say keep it, photograph it, or at least and keep samples if you have to get rid of it.
Yeah, certainly taking photos of the damaged areas are very good. And then that immediate call to your agent or your insurance company, most often they will say, hey, if you've got a wet basement or if you've got some damaged materials, go ahead and as long as you catalog what your damage is, you can start the process of getting rid of it right away. But don't do anything until you've, you know, made contact and made sure that your insurance carrier is aware of the damaged items.
Now, the bad news, probably a lot of people are finding out now, basic homeowners insurance, as I understand it, does not generally cover flood damage. Is that right?
In most cases, yeah, your basic homeowners policy does not provide flood damage. Although, again, you always want to make sure that you put in a call or make a claim to have that insurance company or that adjuster from the company come out and take a look, because there are some provisions in policies where some water damage might be covered. And the other case, as your meteorologist explained earlier, when there are combo events, so you've got a lot of wind, you've got a combination of wind and water, and sometimes that wind will drive the water into your house, and in some cases those damages may be covered. So the wind blows a hole in your house and then the rain comes in, there might be coverage there. So you shouldn't, as a consumer, assume that, oh my gosh, it's all wet, I'm not gonna be able to avail myself of a claim. You've bought that insurance for a reason. It's good to call your company or your agent, get that peace of mind, and that there is coverage, that there isn't, or there may be some coverage at least. Always good to check before you just assume the worst.
For future reference, what kind of flood coverage is available, and who can get it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rob, and that's one of the things that we're actually exploring here at the department. In many cases, in particular, some of the extreme weather events that we've seen in the last couple of weeks here in southern Wisconsin, but also in western Wisconsin, and actually across the state, even parts of eastern Wisconsin, there are areas that weren't traditionally in flood maps or flood zones, so there probably wasn't the availability for consumers to purchase flood coverage from the National Insurance Flood Program, the NFIP. So we are looking at examining whether or not we should be trying to provide more information for consumers who may want to have that extra protection available by purchasing flood insurance through a private carrier. There are some carriers now who are interested in the private market and are making that coverage available. So if your community is not a part of the existing National Flood Insurance Program maps, oftentimes there isn't the availability for that National Flood Insurance program. But what we're looking at right now is to see if there are other options available so consumers can can at least consider that as an option when purchasing homeowners coverage.
How about automobiles damaged by flooding or related weather events?
Right. In automobiles, I don't want to misspeak, but I believe most automobiles would be covered if they were just, you know, parked on the street and were damaged by flood. And again, you want to make sure you're making that call to your auto insurance carrier right away if you've had water damage to your vehicle. Again, don't make the assumption that, oh my gosh, it's you know, it's all gone and I don't have a vehicle. Call your auto insurer right away. Many times those autos are covered by flood, and you should again don't do anything before you contact your auto carrier on those issues as well.
And a press release from your office said after a weather event like this, we should watch out for scams and con artists. What are we watching out for?
Yeah, in the past, particularly in major wind events, there's a very famous phrase, the storm chasers, where you have unlicensed roofers just magically showing up in communities and offering to repair damage post storm, and a lot of them are very aggressive, sweet talking folks who will get you into your kitchen and get you to sign a contract before you've had a chance to talk to your insurance company. They're that quick, and they can move in that quickly. We've done a lot legislatively to keep those groups from coming into the state and having them to be licensed, et cetera. But you still have to worry about scammers preying on you for any number of items, whether it's potentially for mitigation efforts or restoration efforts. You want to contact your insurer first. And if somebody shows up at your door and you're not, you know, you don't know who they are, feel free to talk to them, but don't get into a situation where you've signed a contract and you've made that commitment to them before talking to your insurer. Always work through your insurer first. And then the other area I wanted just to share with you too is on the farm side. I've been looking at some of the photos, a lot of the damage across the state. There's a lot of crop damage as well. So the farmer should make sure they're getting good photos of the damage that they've incurred, and making sure that they're contacting their crop insurers, because it looks like the flooding has destroyed a lot of crops across the state as well.
And then briefly, as we wrap up, does the state have a good resource site or contact for insurance info like this?
Well, the best spot would be contacting my office, oci.wi.gov. I would just say to consumers, if you have questions about your loss, if you have questions about the company who sends an adjuster out and does a quick drive-by and says, oh, no coverage, and you just don't feel right about it, feel free to contact us. It's much better to have our representatives from the insurance department assisting consumers who have questions, so we can make that follow-up call to the insurance company to make sure that they are honoring the terms of the contracts that they're selling to consumers in Wisconsin.
Commissioner Nickel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's been my pleasure.
Ted Nickel is the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner. We talked with him about what to do if severe weather or flooding damages our property. Plus, we talked to Wausau-based meteorologist Chad Franzen. Now, you might have seen them before on your morning commute to work or driving around the state. Ghost bikes, handmade crosses on the side of the road, a telephone pole embellished with pictures, mementos, and the name of someone who's passed on. A lot of us might continue without too much of a thought, but our guest has been slowing down to take a look and take photos of these roadside memorials as part of his project called Not Forgotten. Thomas Ferella is a Wisconsin-based multimedia artist and former emergency medicine physician. He uses his work to comment and respond to social and environmental causes. He's been taking these photos of roadside memorials all over Wisconsin and in Chicago as well for over 20 years. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What caught your eye? Because we've all driven by these things. What made you take notice and take pictures?
Well, I think the first thing that I noticed was the beauty. The fact that these sites are very colorful, they're moving with the wind, the passing of the cars, And that initially attracted my eye. But I think really there was one site in particular, and it involved a young woman that was killed by a car, and I happened to be the physician that took care of her. That also happened to be in my neighborhood, so that was something that I was witnessing on a daily basis in my daily commutes.
Now, yeah, as we said, you're an emergency physician. You treated one of the people who died in this accident. Does this... It seems like this brings it full circle for you in some ways. You've treated accident victims, and now you're seeing how the families are dealing with this afterward.
Yes, but it's on their turf. Mm-hmm. And something, you know, being an emergency physician, I'm used to being in control. But this project has taken me out of that, even though it's trauma related. Now I'm seeing grief very personally in their home territory, so to speak.
Can you talk about some of the different forms these memorials take?
You know, one of the things that's very interesting about these for me, being an artist, is I consider these folk art sites. These are created by people with no artistic training. They are building these things based on a very deep sense of grief. And because of that, they become very personal. There's no overlying architect deciding what goes where. Nobody's coordinating colors. It's all extremely personal. So it becomes poems. It becomes messages to the victim. Maybe their favorite beverage, usually alcohol-related, a half-smoked cigarette of the brand that they smoked, tennis shoes, teddy bears, etc.
And these are usually on the site where someone has died, often in a traffic accident.
Well, correct. But a good 10 to 15% of these sites are actually murder sites. Mm. So, yeah, we think mainly traffic incidents. And, yes, that is true. Most of a motor vehicle crashes, some involving pedestrians and, of course, bicyclists, but also heroin overdoses. Murder sites, senseless violence, trauma from the workplace. It runs the entire gamut.
Now, how do you find these? Do you just drive around looking? Do people know that you're looking for them and let you know, hey, I saw one over here?
There's a bunch of that happening. I'm getting messages a lot of times from police officers who know me and know the project, and family that have... that know of the project, and a lot of it is just serendipity, stumbling upon them while I'm moving about the state.
And now you've got this collection of photos, and as you say, these are folk art, and now you're taking the lens and framing them in a way. How are you trying to capture these and pay tribute to the families who created these?
You know, the obvious thing is to take a picture of the entire site, just to document that. But for me, the power comes from stopping, looking, and being up close and personal. And a lot of the images, if you do go to the site, will show these very personal images. A lot of them seem extremely pedantic to someone like you or myself, but you know there's meaning when you really take a look, like the half-smoked cigarette or a particular figurine. Or a basketball. You know, a very touching memorial is one on the west side here in Madison, and it's a cross, and it has the word dad on it, very big and prominent. And on this cross have been pounded small little McDonald toys, obviously from the children.
Have you talked to some of the families who have made these?
Yes. And in fact, the Chicago project, we talked to almost everybody that was building the memorials. In Madison, it's a little bit more difficult because the memorials can be very isolated, very rural. It's hard to find a lot of times who actually passed on that site. So a lot of these sites, even though I've done some research, are unknowns. And of course, because of the vast nature of the landscape, it's hard to figure out who exactly built them and who was responsible for them. So, yes and no.
Do these come and go, or are people maintaining them over time?
Both. They are very transient in that nature takes its toll. And in fact, the patina of the natural elements really lends, in my mind, a very an incredible timeless beauty to these places. I also found out through the Chicago Project that the police were removing them as fast as they could be put up because retribution violence was occurring at the site of the memorial. So they can be very ephemeral. And in fact, the longest one I have is up near Plain, Wisconsin, and that's been maintained since the early 60s from three high school students that died in a traffic accident there.
What does this make you think about the way we grieve?
Well, I think that's changing. I look at grieving historically like everybody else. It's, and I talk about this when I give a talk about this project, is that grief tends to be in a three-box system. People die in the hospital. We're told the rules there. They get seen at a funeral home. We're told the rules there. And then they get placed in a cemetery, and we're told what the rules are there. These memorials have empowered people, and I don't know exactly where that comes from, though I'm very curious and have done a lot of reading, but it empowers people to declare a ordinary piece of real estate as being sacred. And they're doing this outside of the state government, and they're doing this outside of religion, which I find very fascinating.
It's a good place to leave it. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thomas Ferrella is a Wisconsin-based artist and former emergency medicine physician. He's been taking photos of these roadside memorials all over Wisconsin for his series, Not Forgotten, Wisconsin Roadside Memorials. You can see his photos and where they were taken at wisconsinroadsidememorials.com. It shouldn't come as a surprise that people on the autism spectrum want a social circle of friends and colleagues like anybody else. But when the first published report of autism came out more than 75 years ago, it described those with autism as, quote, happiest when left alone. That belief is still around, but many researchers and people with autism are pushing back against that idea. They say that friendship and social connections are valuable for people with autism, but different communication styles can get in the way. And there are things those of us not on the spectrum can keep in mind to make sure that we're being open and available to people on the autism spectrum. Monica Nishik is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a mental health clinician at UW Health. She's worked extensively with people with autism, anxiety, OCD, attachment concerns, challenging behavior, and depression. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, in your work and your education, for that matter, is this an idea that comes up a lot, that people with autism, they don't really want those social connections?
Yeah, I think that there can be a lot of differences in how they communicate with people, or just they might have difficulties with social communication or making eye contact or talking about things or even starting conversations with other people. And so that might send the message that they're just not interested.
And apparently this was an academic belief when autism was first being described, that it's not just miscommunication, it's a lack of desire for social connection. But not true, though.
No, and I think the one thing to consider is that not everybody on the autism spectrum is the same, mm-hmm. just the same with people who describe themselves as neurotypical. So you certainly have people, I have friends who aren't very interested in social interactions or hanging out with people. So you can find that in the community. But I think overall, they have the same desires and needs for human connection.
And it seems like people are working sort of from both ends, working with people with autism on reading social cues and for people without autism to read the social cues of people with. Let's start on working with people with autism. What kind of things might they be doing to try to say, okay, what is the social cue I'm getting? How do I respond to this?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting idea, because when I first started working with people on the spectrum, I was kind of blown away at all of the things that we do socially that are kind of intuitive to us that we don't really think about. So I know that when I'm having a conversation with you, that maybe I shouldn't make eye contact for too long. I shouldn't just stare at you. I can also tell by your nonverbal cues, maybe if you're not interested in the topics that I'm talking about anymore, and I might kind of shift and talk about something else or ask you about your day. So I would definitely say that communication, both verbal and nonverbal, are some of the biggest difficulties, as well as reading other people's emotions and kind of those subtleties in communication.
Is this something, you know, as you say, we take it for granted, people who are neurotypical, I think is the commonly used phrase. Is this something that if you haven't picked that up, is it learnable? Is this something that people can pick up with some work?
Yeah, it definitely is. It requires, you have to look at all of the different steps that go into communication. And so sometimes I think that makes it a little difficult. So I've taught people how to make an appropriate amount of eye contact with others. I've worked with people on starting conversations and ending conversations appropriately. There's just a lot more steps or a lot more things that you have to think about.
We're talking to Monica Nishik from UW Health about communication between people on the autism spectrum and people who aren't on that autism spectrum, and how we can all read each other's cues a little bit better. Now, let's come at this from the other angle. And let's start with that one specific thing. You mentioned that often, not always, but often people on the autism spectrum avoid eye contact or don't feel comfortable with eye contact, and that is misread by people not on the spectrum as saying, oh, this person doesn't want to communicate. This person doesn't want to talk to me. That's fine. How could the rest of us look at that signal and maybe read it a little better?
I think the number one thing would be not to make assumptions about someone, and maybe to just ask them about their experiences being on the autism spectrum and how that interacts with them. Or what challenges that they might have because of that, or what strengths they might have because of that. But I think assumptions are kind of what gets us in trouble, and not asking questions. So I'd really encourage people to be curious. Or if someone that you're speaking to maybe pauses for a while or isn't responding to you, you know, maybe asking a follow-up question like, are you still thinking about that, or do you need some more time? And not to just assume that they're not interested.
Right. In our daily social interactions out in the world, we might well not know that we're talking to someone who, you know, I don't know if someone is on the autism spectrum or not just by interacting with them or talking with them. So how can we just, I guess, have a baseline assumption of like, okay, I'm not going to shut this down based on some of these cues?
Again, I think just not making assumptions about who you're talking to. You can always ask questions, or you can lead the conversation. So if you feel like someone is maybe not being as open with you, then you can kind of take the lead and ask them like what they're up to or what some of their interests are.
And I don't want to paint too broad a brush. You mentioned earlier people on the autism spectrum, that might mean a lot of different things for different people. Can you talk about the diversity within what we're calling the autism spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, recently with the DSM-5, the diagnosis has kind of changed for autism spectrum disorders, and in a lot of ways it became a lot more broad. And some ways it kind of narrowed it down a little bit. But yeah, you can have people who are on the spectrum who are nonverbal and maybe have a lot of like functional needs that they need to work on or need to get met. And then kind of, as you mentioned, you can have people that you would meet and you would have no idea that they were on the autism spectrum. So it can really be that wide or that varied.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Ruth on the line in Madison. Ruth, hi.
Hi. So I'm 65 years old, and I don't see where I would benefit from having an official diagnosis, but nothing else explains my life. And what happens to me is people will start finishing my sentences wrong. And then the more they say wrong, the more I feel like I have to explain why it's not that. And then it just gets to be this pile of questions. And the more frustrated I get, the less access I have to my words. And so I want to just scream. And I see sometimes at the daycare where I work where the kids are just screaming, and the parents are acting like the child is angry. And I can tell you that child isn't angry. That child is frustrated. And I think that when a person perceive somebody else as angry, then their visceral reaction is hostile. And when they perceive that person as frustrated, their visceral reaction is more helpful. And my husband has learned that when I've lost my words and he can just see the expression on my face, he'll just say, "What is it that you need us to understand?" And then it brings me back to the first question that was what I wanted to answer in the first place, not that whole tangled pile of questions that, you know, are you this, are you that, is it this, is it that? No, stop.
Ruth, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience, not, as she says, officially diagnosed, but a little bit self-diagnosed on the autistic spectrum. Is this a story you've encountered?
Yeah, I think that just goes back to patience and kind of asking, you know, like her husband does, like, what do you actually need or what are you actually asking me for? And especially with younger kids, they may not be able to verbalize what they actually need or what they actually want. And that doesn't just apply to people who are nonverbal and on the spectrum.
What's your advice for parents or teachers working with a child with autism who does have that trouble expressing their needs?
I think number one is trying to figure out what they are trying to communicate with you. So even if they are nonverbal, all behavior is communication. So most of us aren't just, you know, walking around being angry or being frustrated just for the heck of it. You know, there is a reason underlying that. And so, again, trying to be curious and trying to figure out why might they be responding this way and how can I teach them to communicate that to me in the future so I can help them.
We're talking with Monica Nishik, a mental health clinician at UW Health and licensed marriage and family therapist. She's with us to talk about ways to build connections between people on and off the autism spectrum. Want to hear from you. Are you or someone you close to on the autism spectrum? What should other people listening know about the social experience of living on the spectrum? Tell us about your relationship or experiences making friends. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up the conversation about how to bridge the social gap between people who are on and who are off the autism spectrum. Monica Nishik is a mental health clinician at UW Health and a licensed family and marriage counselor. And we want to hear from you. If you're on the spectrum yourself, what's your experience been like building relationships? What do you wish you could change? What do you wish other people not on the spectrum knew? And if you're a family member or work with people with autism, what do you think other people should know? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Monica, before we go back to our callers, are there social barriers that people on the autism spectrum might have that the rest of us might not think about?
Yeah, as I stated earlier, some of those social cues that kind of come to us intuitively, we don't really think about doing them. And so when you're interacting with someone or someone on the autism spectrum, they're also having to keep all of these things in their mind at once, right? Like, am I appropriately judging if this person is interested? Am I making eye contact? Have I been talking too long? I also think there isn't always, but there can be some limited interests with people with autism, and it might be harder to find natural social connections just in everyday life. You know, my interest might be some video games that no one at my school is interested in, for example.
Let's go back to our callers now. Russell is on the line in Wisconsin Rapids. Russell, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Russell?
Well, I'm an NT, a neurotypical. My wife, Amanda, she is previously diagnosed as Asperger's, which has now been termed just regular autism spectrum disorder, and our 13-year-old son is also on the spectrum. For my wife, when she's in a social interaction of any kind, it can become physically exhausting to her to try to understand the social cues, the niceties, the eye contact, and it is actually draining on her to where she needs time to recuperate afterward. For my son, he doesn't get the social cues either, and if you try to correct him, he becomes very frustrated, very angry with it, because he knows he doesn't get it, but he thinks other people just accept it and move on.
Russell, thank you so much. He talked about it being physically exhausting. And Monica, I was thinking that when you were talking about how someone might have to think through every social cue, I mean, it's like me trying to dance and think, where is my arm? Where is my leg? Like having to concentrate that much in a social interaction. Tiring, right?
Yeah, definitely. And just to his point, too, about his son. So none of us really like receiving feedback. And so if you think about being on the spectrum and kind of constantly getting this feedback, because we need to have it because we need to understand what, you know, maybe where we messed up in a social interaction or maybe where we could use some help. But that would just be mentally exhausting for anyone.
Thanks a lot for that call, Russell. So how do you come up with a feedback method, I guess, especially for a young person that helps them develop these skills but doesn't get them ticked off all the time?
One really good method is actually using role play. And so I would do that a lot with the teenagers and young adults that I would work with, especially before they would go into something like a job situation or a work situation. So we would kind of take turns being each other and coaching each other. So I think the more practice you can have kind of outside of that actual social situation, the better.
Thanks again for the call, Russell. We'll go next to Jason in Wisconsin Dells. Jason, hi.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jason?
Well, I just wanted to thank you and your panelist, Monica, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I just want to thank you for bringing this to the attention and putting it on the radio and just sort of raising awareness. I have a 10-year-old son who's actually diagnosed at UW by Dr. Ayama, and I just want to say you're exactly right you hit the nail on the head with everything you said, how it can be exhausting, how, you know, they can't read and, you know, even talking to my own son, I have to, hey, kind of look me in the eye, bud, you know, just make sure I've got his attention. It's just, you know, certain situations can be, you know, physically taxing on him as well. I mean, everything that previous callers have said is pretty spot on, you know, just waiting in line, for example, at amusement parks and such, it just gets him, wears him out. And I just wanted to thank you. I know this has kind of become a growing concern and, nationwide. I just wanted to, listening on the radio as I'm traveling, and I thought, well, I just want to call in and lend my support and say thank you for this.
Jason, thank you so much for sharing that. Do you, Monica, see more people being interested in talking about this, not just families with somebody on the autism spectrum, but in the general public?
Yeah, definitely. I think we can kind of argue if prevalence is increasing or if we're just getting better at diagnosing autism. But I think certainly you can kind of go out on the street and talk to anyone and they have a connection to someone with autism. And so just more awareness and more communication and the more that we can talk about it, the better.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking about building bridges between people on and off the autism spectrum, overcoming some of the communication barriers that can come up on both sides of the conversation. Monica, let's take this into a school setting. What can families and schools do to work together to help prevent that kid on the autism spectrum from being or feeling isolated at school?
Yeah, well, this is certainly dependent, I think, on the age of the kid, but I've worked a lot with kids on creating stories about themselves, either in like PowerPoint presentations or just like little booklets. And those specifically tell teachers things that are difficult for them, any like underlying sensory, so like sound or sights or even touch issues that they might have. Sometimes kids really have a hard time with large groups of people, and so maybe being in a small classroom is something that would work for this kiddo. And so I think really helping the individual create their own plan is the biggest key to success.
And what would you want the other kids in the classroom? Let's take this like to early elementary school, the neurotypical kids, to know about children with autism and how they can connect.
I think going back to kind of what I said earlier is that their behavior is just trying to use it as a way of communication. So, you know, even if it looks like they're having a hard time or, you know, they're becoming upset or aggressive or angry, that's just because they're trying to figure out how to understand their body and get their needs met. So I think, again, just teaching patience and curiosity to kids as much as we can.
I know there's a Sesame Street character, I can't think of her name, who's on the autism spectrum. Do you see that kind of a public attention making a difference for what kids are ready to encounter?
Yeah, definitely. And I think just in pop culture in general, we've started to bridge that gap a little bit better. There have been more characters like on that show Parenthood, and there's a show on Netflix that's really good as well. And I think just showing kind of that spectrum of autism again is really helpful.
Let's go to Jonah now in Madison. Jonah, hi.
So I am diagnosed with autism, and I would be on what people would call the upper end of the autism spectrum. So people necessarily interacting with me wouldn't necessarily know that I had autism just by, like, talking to me. I mean, my own family and me didn't even really know what was going on until I was about 10.
And now that you know, have things changed for you, Jonah?
Yes, very much. I have gotten help that I really, really, really appreciate and needed. And, things have gotten a lot easier for me.
How so?
But, I've started to go to social skills classes, and I have also, like, just learned about things called hidden rules, which are, like, social cues that other people who don't have autism, like, automatically know, but, like, autistic people have to figure them out.
All right, Jonah, thanks so much for calling and sharing your story. So giving that kind of help for someone like Jonah can make a big difference.
Yeah, and I think research has really improved, and especially into working with kids who aren't really young. So working with school-age kids, teenagers, and into young adulthood. There's still, you know, now there's social skills programs for different age groups. They're not as many as I would like there to be, but I think that has really helped.
Jonah, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your story. In our last few minutes, Monica, leave us with a message for the neurotypical community. You can cover some of the ground we've covered already. What should we be thinking about?
Again, I think be patient, be curious. Ask questions specific to that person's experience and what they're going through. And, you know, just make sure that you're being as supportive as possible and not making assumptions about people on the spectrum.
We'll leave it there. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Monica Nishik, a licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health clinician at UW Health. She's worked extensively with people with autism, anxiety, OCD, attachment concerns, challenging behavior, and depression across the lifespan since 2010. We've been talking about ways for people on and off the autism spectrum to communicate, get along, build bridges, and build relationships with one another. You can keep tweeting us, by the way, at Central Time WPR. Is this your story? Is this part of your life? What do you want people to know about life as a person with autism and how to communicate with one another? Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Tap your heels together 3 times and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home.
So there's Dorothy clicking her heels together. And what's on her feet while they're clicking? The ruby slippers, right? Well, it turns out there's been a mystery about those slippers, and it got at least partly solved, according to the FBI earlier today. There are actually at least 4 pairs of these slippers made for The Wizard of Oz. We know where 3 of them have been. But the pair in that scene, the star slippers for the close-ups, they've been missing since 2005 when they were stolen from the Judy Garland Museum in her hometown in Minnesota. Estimated value, they were insured for $1 million. The museum thought that if they sold them, which they wouldn't, they'd sell for 2 or 3 times that. Well, today, here's the FBI. They say they have the slippers with the help of the Smithsonian. They've confirmed that they're the real deal. But they're a little vague on the details. The FBI says they recovered the slippers in, quote, an undercover operation in Minneapolis. Apparently, the case was cracked when someone contacted the insurance company in what turned out to be an effort to extort money from the people who had the slippers. The FBI is still looking for information from the public on the theft and the extortion scheme. Now, what would you do with these slippers? If I had them, I guess I'd never buy a round-trip ticket ever again. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel.